also do those for me. And now the idea is you'll send me a transcript once you've done it.
Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh.
And we'll, you know, I'm sure just judging from the way the questions are being said, I'm sure we won't have many problems. We will just see that we're all happy with the final outcome.
Yes. Right.
I just want to.
No. Nobody's ever been unhappy yet.
I'm sure. No. I mean, I can just see. I do want to ask you for two things. One, if you've dug up as much stuff as you have, and probably more stuff that is represented here, I would be very...
Obviously, you know, obviously the closer to the... if you want microphones, the better, but right. they're good microphones, and they should be able to get you no matter where you stand.
Well, let me thank you again for taking all this trouble and for coming.
Quite an honor.
Question one is, much of your work deals with the centrality of discourse and the importance of writing. Be it in the inscription of writing of identity, the writing of hybrid colonial subject, or the writing of the narrative of nationness. And, of course, you yourself have written a substantial body of works for both scholarly publications and more public forums such as the New Statesman Society and Art Forum. Do you think of yourself as a writer?
Yes, very much so. In fact, when I was an undergraduate at the Elphinstone College in the University of Bombay, it always surprised me how completely absorbed I would be when I wrote my rather small and worthless poems entirely enchanted by the form and the activity. And somehow the agony in creative writing, as they call it, seemed to be much sweeter than the agony in theoretical writing. And it just surprised me how completely absorbing it was to decide to use one word rather than another. And I wrote rather short poems. That was the form I worked in. But I think the consequences of that in my present work are that I'm very fascinated by doing the theory by doing a certain kind of writing. To me, the idea has to shape, enact the rhetoric. There is no concept, I feel, that can sort of stand on its own with great clarity if the writing is workmanlike and clumsy, or clumsy. So to me, the writing of the theory, the writing of the concept is very, very important. And I think I sort of inspire myself quite often by starting my theoretical or conceptual pieces with bits of writing that inspire me to a certain fineness of expression. I mean, one of the things I often do is to read some completely unconnected work before I start writing. I mean, I often read W.H. Auden, who at the moment I was a great favorite of mine, by reading Robert Lowell, again, often poetry. Just as a matter of practice, just as a sort of a ritual to begin writing a piece that has nothing to do with it. But so I have this great respect, to use a word, this great respect and desire for fine writing. And very often I will do something or use a word which stretches a point, just because I feel that it takes the thought somewhat further than I may have, than it may need to go, but the suggestiveness of that word both enacts a kind of finer sense and sentiment even though it would have been easier to close it down with a more workmanlike word, which would have, you know, done the job and nailed it down. But I prefer to keep that open. I also remember, you know, Toni Morrison saying to me once, you know, writing is all, if you can't do it in the writing and through the writing, if you can't do this whole kind of revisionary history of slavery and sexuality that she's involved in some of her work, you can't do it in and through the actual writing. You can't do it by giving people ideas or thoughts. The two things have to really work together. And that is why I, you know, that is what I do try and do. In a way, writing to me is the staging of an idea. And I use that with its full theatrical and operatic and dramatic possibilities, you know, in the way in which the concept might be the armature or the architecture of the idea.
It's a wonderful answer.
Thank you.
The second question is, in the postcolonial and the postmodern, you discuss Barthes' attempt to think outside the sentence. You write, the hierarchy and the subordinations of the sentence are replaced by the definitive discontinuity of the text. And what emerges is a form of writing that Barthes describes as writing out loud, or aloud. You continue, if you seek simply the sententious or the exegetical, you will not grasp the hybrid moment outside the sentence. Not quite experience, not yet concept. Part dream, part analysis. Neither signifier nor signify. This intermediate space between theory and practice disrupts the disciplinary semiology, semiological demand to enumerate all the languages within earshot. Now, this is an elegant theoretical intervention, and it's useful on a number of levels. However, those of us in rhetoric and composition are charged with helping students to be in the sentence in a way, to compose clear sententious prose. Now, do you believe that teachers of writing should problematize the dynamics of discourse by introducing discussions of sententiousness?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think sententiousness is a particular ideology of rhetoric, it is a particular history. 18th century sententiousness, for instance, was a very dominant form. It is related to various discourses like the law or like political edicts. It is part of a rhetoric of governance and authority. So I think some awareness of what sententiousness is as a production, as a process of communication, its conditions, is very important. I also think that it is very important to teach students, people to write in a way that is clear, that does communicate what it is that they want to say effectively, so that they can feel represented. There is no totality of representation, but I think people should feel in the sentence, if you like, or in the language, that they can represent themselves. I know that this links later on with this question of literacy, which you raised very importantly. However, like all pedagogical forms, you know, I think sententiousness must also keep open for itself the possibility that where the sentence falls, where it will be taken up again, where the pause occurs in the sententiousness, where there is a hesitation within it, is not just a disturbance, it's not just an abnorm of the sententiousness, but it could be the place for a resistance to its authority, for the re-elaboration of its object of attention. So to me, the possibility of opening up the, or of seeing the borders of sententiousness as porous, not in some simply dyadic form that the sententious is the authoritative and the non-sententious is the marginal or the subaltern or the resistant, not at all like that, but to continually see sententiousness as transforming, you know, as Henry James once said, forms of relationship that really don't end anywhere. Mm-hmm. That the sententiousness is itself an emergence, is itself not an origin but an emergence, is very important, because I think then one is open to other residual and emergent and marginal forms of meaning making or communication or subject identification. So I think my suggestion that we should look in a way beyond the sentence is not to say, as is often said now in a kind of flippant way, that you know, we should move beyond rationalism or something of that kind, or rationality. But it is to say that there are other logics of signification to which we should actually be open, and the sentence can sometimes sentence us in the imprisoning sense to the kind of prison house of a particular language form.
Somehow we thought you were going to answer that way. Thank you. The third one is the commitment to theory represents a carefully elaborated view of the interaction of politics, rhetoric, and theory. You're right. Political positions are not simply identifiable as progressive or reactionary, bourgeois or radical, prior to the act of critique and gage, or outside the terms and conditions of their discursive address. It is in this sense that the historical moment of political action must be thought of as a part of the history of the form of its writing. This is not to state the obvious, that there is no knowledge, political or otherwise, outside representation. It is to suggest that the political, as a form of calculation and strategic action dedicated to social transformation, must acknowledge the force of writing, its metaphoricity, and its rhetorical discourse, as a productive matrix which defines the social and makes it available as an object of and for action. Now, some compositionists may understand this view as a confirmation that writing is the central political act, and therefore that writing instruction is an important form of political activism. Do you place any limits on the political effectivity of writing, or for that matter, the field of composition itself, if you'd like to address that? And if so, what are they?
Well, before I answer, let me just interject and say one of the, as somebody who, as you quite rightly detected, is very keen on writing, I would like to compliment you on the form of the writing of these questions, because I had the experience when reading them that the next question was really anticipating a thought that was developing. So I think that they really move very well, and the interconnections are not only serial, they go in many directions. But I think these are very finely cast. To go back to your question, I think I would want to say absolutely that writings, if I might use that word, an inscription, by which I'm not only talking about printed writing or writings, we understand it. I'm talking about the possibility of making a determining mark on a surface. It may be a social surface, it may be a visual screen. I'm talking about writing in the widest sense of a kind of ordering of things or ordering of communication in one way in the context of a wider contingent structure. That's what I'm talking about. You know, certain forms of ritual could be inscriptive in that way. Certain modes of political organization could be inscriptive in that way too. So, having said that, let me say that I do feel that even in the more narrow sense, if you like, writing is, and composition is, I think, a highly political activity. Are we okay? Is a political activity. There is a politics of instruction, there is a politics of composition. some of my graduate students come to me and say that the, I don't know whether this should be in the interview or not, but I'm slightly piqued about it, that the writing program, and maybe I shouldn't say this shouldn't be, but the writing program in Chicago, they don't get taken up. Mm-hmm. And I think, unfortunately for them, it's to do, in fact, they've told me that, but the rumor is, oh, your Homi Bhabha's students, oh, well, the guy can't write, you know, what are you going to be able to teach anybody to write? Yeah. I have heard this. Now they're in the process of completely rejigging the writing program here. There's a search for a new head, etc., etc. I don't know, but I have heard this, that they say, you know, my students have not been silly. They get instructorships all over the place. But they don't get taken out of this writing program. Anyway, so it is even political in that sense.
Oh, yes.
Is what I wanted to say.
Yeah.
Your question was about the limits on the political effectivity of writing. I think my thought about that is that too often writing is treated, now in the broadest sense, as a communicational medium where the subjects of that communication are constituted prior to the writing, where the objects of that communication are also constituted prior to that writing. And what writing has to do is transparently mediate between already pre-given subjects, pre-given objects, and a pre-constituted mise-en-scène. Mm-hmm. My interest is in suggesting that the agency of writing actually constitutes, in a dialogic way, new relationships between elements that may or may not be pre-given, such that the pre-givenness is questioned. Mm-hmm. The pre-constitutedness is questioned. So of course, you know, there are certain conditions, there are certain determinants which precede a particular act of communication or writing or mediation. But what happens in and through the writing is the reconjugation of those given conditions. Mm-hmm. And that is what I believe to be the effectivity of writing as a kind of agency, as a performance, as a practice, and as a process, which is too little understood. I chose here to talk about metaphoricity, because metaphoricity is one of those moments, even more widely recognized, where you have to stop and think where the writing act is going, what it is trying to constitute, beyond what it is in some transparent way saying, the doubleness of the inscriptive act. So I do think that the activity of writing is in that sense continually a revisionary or even in some ways revolutionary activity. I don't mean revolutionary capital R, you know, not in right. some sort of political adventurist sense, you right. know, as I could be understood. I'm just saying it's a continual movement, and in the piece in Critical Inquiry in the margin or whatever, Minority Maneuvers, that essay, it was my purpose to actually talk about political movement as movement, and indeed writing itself as a kind of movement. Could you just let me open the door?
I think this is okay, then question number four is...
Can I just finish that earlier one?
Oh, my
just,
yeah.
just one little thing
Sir,
I wanted to say.
Continue on.
Which may just actually fix this.
Oh, we should say hello to you.
I just wanted to add there that we've talked about this active, indeed even proactive, indeed even revisionary medium of writing. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to think in the widest sense of what a politics might be conceived in that way. I just want to add that writing, therefore, is itself a mediation. It's not a medium, it's a mediation. And critics and philosophers and political thinkers are so easily able to conceive of the mediatory nature of individuals, for instance, or of a particular kind of institutional form. Mm-hmm. But in a way, writing, which scribbles over all these things, subtends them. Writing in the sense, as I stress again, the wider sense, you know, the inscription of a mark, the making of an order, somehow that is relegated to a transparency, you know, as if it is following on from positions, objects, subjects already constituted. So it's that I'm trying to get at in that passage that you highlighted.
Thank you. Question number four is, you comment that you have tried to erase the popular binarism between theory and politics, the intellectual and activist. And you say that it is a sign of political maturity to accept that there are many forms of political writing whose different effects are obscured when they are divided between the theoretical and the activist. It's not as if the leaflet involved in the organization of a strike is short on theory, while the speculative article on the theory of ideology ought to have more practical examples or applications. They are both forms of discourse, and to that extent they produce rather than reflect their objects of reference. The difference between them lies in their operational qualities. Now, of course, such a position enters into the larger debate over the efficacy of theoretical work in the public domain, whether critical theory can ever be truly activist or achieve ends in the world beyond the academy. What do you see as the role of theory in the world outside the academy? And incidentally, what are the operational qualities that distinguish the work of theory from that of other kinds of work?
Thank you.
It's actually an important question to us.
Right, good. And I see the section that you have chosen from the commitment to theory, and I think it took me some time to write that. But let me just say, if I cut to the bone, I think that the operational quality of theory in the public domain is to break the continuity and the consensus of common sense. It is to break it and to break into it. And for too often, the breaking into common sense has been represented as some deconstructive work of ideology critique or symptomatic reading, which then takes that commonsensical false consciousness or ideological perspective and puts a kind of carapace of conceptual order around it. I can see both historically and philosophically why that should happen, and when it has happened, you know, in the last two decades, for instance, the very useful, very brilliant work of Louis Althusser, not so much in itself, but in his followers, you know, produced precisely that kind of response, that people looked, if you like, theoretically, quote-unquote, for the fissures in common sense, and then sort of actually occupying those fissures, which is what I think the work of theory is, and seeing where else it would get you. If your ontology or your genealogy was a fissured one, then where else would it get you? How would you work through it? What they did was to pour the cement of their own theoretical position into the fissure and covered it up. And I always felt uncomfortable with that, even when I didn't have the theoretical language to deal with it. I'm now, you know, talking of seminars in the mid-late 70s in Oxford where there wasn't any theoretical work except through the, you know, brilliance and the generosity of Terry Eagleton, one seminar a week where we would go to discuss such matters. But even at that time, it felt that for me, conceptually, this, you know, this filling up of the fissure, detecting it and then filling it up, was not the appropriate thing. But for me, it's always been to try and, if you actually now repositioned yourself in the fissure as a form of knowledge, as a mode of signification, as a place of enunciation, where would you get to? What would you do? What possibilities would be opened out for you? Not to come with your own, you know, already constituted resolution to the fissure. Of course, you come with a whole lot of preconstituted baggage, but the whole point is, how can your baggage be thrown around? How can it be challenged by the fissuring? And that's why I say, again, where I started off, to me, to both intervene in the continuity and consensus of common sense, or commonsensicality, and also to the use of theory must be, I think, to interrupt the dominant and dominating strategies of generalization within a cultural or a communicative or interpretational community. Precisely where that community wants, in a very settled and stentorian way, to say this is the general and this is the case, this is the principle and this is its empirical application, as a form of proof and justification, I think the importance of theory is to unsettle the complacency of those relations. I think, if I might speak both theoretically and figuratively at once, the role of theory is precisely that kind of alienation and distanciation that, say, Brecht talks about. It's also, in another kind of philosophical register, and I'm being translated here, the moment, snatching the moment that flashes up in a situation of danger or emergency that Benjamin talks about. But I want to give you a third example where I think, which does the work of theory, which is often seen to be an applicative or bridging work, and in some ways it is, but it's bridging in the sense that Heidegger talks. He says, until you throw the bridge across the river, you don't quite know what the banks are. You don't know what you're calculating. And I think theory works in that way. There is a second section, or a second emphasis in your question, as I understand it, which is to do with the operational nature, of the theoretical, the operational qualities that we need to distinguish. I think, for me, the theoretical, which I said a moment ago, is part of this intervention into the consensus and continuum of common sense. The purpose of theoretical is to make us aware of what it would be to deal with processes, subjects, or objects in transition. Transitionality has been, for me, a guiding problem. That's exactly what it's a problem. How to deal with the transitional. And various things that I've emphasized in the construction of social reality, in the construction of subject formation, in the construction of meaning, things like ambivalence, are to me important and become subjects for theoretical speculation, because they have within them this agonistic, unresolved moment of transition, and they also demand a certain kind of ethical responsibility to negotiate that. Theory has been important for me operationally in these ways.
That's very useful, thank you. The fifth question is, you write in The Location of Culture, I've chosen to demonstrate the importance of the space of writing and the problematic of address at the very heart of the liberal tradition, because it is here that the myth of the transparency of the human agent and the reasonableness of political action is most forcefully asserted. And despite the more radical political alternatives of the right and the left, the popular common sense view of the place of the individual in relation to the social is still substantially thought and lived in ethical terms molded by liberal beliefs. What the attention to rhetoric and writing reveals is the discursive ambivalence that makes the political possible. Now, this view seems to suggest that the crucial function of the textual and the rhetorical is to make political struggle possible by drawing attention to discursive ambivalence.
I think that's a fair reading, but let's flesh it out. Let's flesh it out some more. Because what address does, what the notion of address does, is to draw your attention, if I may be figurative, not only to the place where the sign emerges in a particular discourse or a particular speech act, but how it flies and then falls at a point of relocation. That's what address is, how it moves from one space to another. Now, ambivalence is very important in order to contest forms of rationalism, not rationality, but rationalism, that want to ascribe certain kinds of intentionality and achieved intentionality as somehow flying through what we talked about earlier, is this transparent and immaterial medium. My emphasis on address is to always suggest that where the sign emerges and where it ends up may be it may have incommensurable and contradictory terrains of inscription at either end. So to that extent, I think in the widest sense, where address addresses the problem of the construction of social meaning, or the ascription of a person or peoples, etc. To me, the important thing about writing, and indeed, it's the ambivalent structure of the sign in its emergence and its destination, if you like, is to be aware that politically we are continually constructing the constituencies which we address, just as we're constructing the objects of value which we are transmitting. And this, therefore, does not enable you to give a universal and transhistorical value to things like virtue or tolerance or secularism, or indeed the sacred. I think this makes you each time recalibrate, because you know you are constructing the constituency and indeed the consistency of language and thought, which you are then pointing to digitally. Is that all right?
That's wonderful, thank you. In The Commitment to Theory, you effectively challenge critical theorists, particularly materialists, to avoid the kind of political idealism in which theory merely develops and augments an a priori political principle or commitment, or what you call identikit political idealism. The language of critique is affected, you argue, not because it keeps separate the terms of opposition, but to the extent to which it overcomes the given grounds of opposition and opens up a space of translation, a place of hybridity, figuratively speaking, where the construction of a political object that is new, neither one nor the other, properly alienates our political expectations and changes, as it must, the very forms of our recognition of the moment of politics. The opening up of this space of translation is a sign that history is happening within the pages of theory. Here you offer a view of theory that is more rhetorical than that of identikit political idealism. You claim it is deeper and more dangerous. Now, what makes the passage of history in theory more dangerous?
Thank you. Well, when I use the term passage of history in theory there, I want to suggest three ways of reading that Dosha passage. One, a passage more spatially as opening up a space. Two, passage as a kind of movement, like in a rite of passage, a particular movement. You know, a rite of passage is a way not only of thinking transformation, but of thinking the transition that is involved in making the transformation. And I want to make a distinction there. And then I also want to think about passage as a piece of inscription, you know, as we might say, a passage in a book, you know, which has many of those meanings. It opens up something, it takes you from somewhere to somewhere, and also in itself, however, it holds you in that moment of transition. So there is those three ways of thinking of passage in that phrase in the location of culture. And I think my interest there is, again, relates to something we talked about earlier, which is to unsettle either the kind of conceptual mastery of what is understood to be theory, you know, as some kind of x-raying mechanism which will take you to the bare bones of a situation, on the one hand, but also to contest the authority that is given very often to historical event, as if, you know, it is somehow there, and it is there preceding our theoretical attention, that, you know, when we attend to it, we attend to an already given and established reality. It's to open, really, a passage between those two which makes either of those positions untenable, that I stress, and my language here is somewhat Benjaminian again, and particularly from the essay, not the essay on translation, but the essay on the ends of languages in the ends of man, or whatever that language in the end of man, where he says, you know, the important thing about translation is to focus on the continuum of transformation, all those small micro movements which you can only, which if you only look at the large arch, and if you look at the dominant passage of history, you will miss. It's those micro movements that happen in the midst of, in the middenness of, moments of change or of transformation that I think need to be attended to. Because if you don't attend to them, the temptation is always to fall into large claims about identity and difference, not to see the negotiatory strategies by which positions or persons or cultures get constituted. And it's for that reason that I think such a passage in the various meanings that I've given to the term must be kept open in a way between or in order not to allow the arrogance of theory or indeed the arrogance of history to settle into their own mastering discourses.
That's very useful. Thank you. One of the most important theoretical innovations you offer is the distinction you draw between cultural diversity and cultural difference. You say that cultural diversity is the recognition of pre-given cultural contents and customs. Held in a time frame of relativism, it gives rise to liberal notions of multiculturalism, cultural exchange, or the culture of humanity. Cultural diversity is also the representation of a radical rhetoric of the separation of totalized cultures that live unsullied by the intertextuality of their historical locations, safe in the utopianism of a mythic memory or a unique collective identity. To trouble, if not displace, this notion of cultural diversity in the liberal and left progressive projects of multiculturalism it underwrites, you suggest a rather complex notion of cultural difference as a kind of adding to that doesn't add up. Would you explain more specifically what you mean bicultural difference. And as a footnote, let me just say that this is an issue that's of importance right now in a lot of the scholarship in the field that we're doing, and I think this distinction is something they really need to hear.
Well, let me start with a... Thank you. Let me start with a rather abstract formulation, which I'll try then to flesh out, and let's see how successful it is. If not, we can have another strategy for this question. You know, the same, you take the adding to without adding up from dissemination. And in that same essay, I also say something else, which is that we should never simply conjoin or elide the difference between the repetition of the symbol and the iteration of the sign. Mm-hmm. And I think this relates back to what we were talking about in terms of address. So that quite often, the difference of cultures is in fact read on the similarity of certain signs that work their ways through cultures. As indeed, particular cultures are unified mm-hmm. by finding, through the concept of tradition, for instance, similarities over time, as the phrase has it. My concern is that cultural difference is constituted in a kind of agonistic and unresolved tension between those two things. The moment of recognition, where a community or a culture recognizes itself in some generalizing practice. But then there has to be the other work, which is, however, that particular practice could be a practice of inheritance, it could be a practice to do with certain ritual, affects different members of that culture very differently. And indeed, in the translation, from the general, more pedagogical level to the performative level within that culture, there can be oppositionality. So that, to me, cultural difference is the awareness that, first of all, you have the problem of difference, not because there are many cultures, reconstituted cultures. You know, that notion that cultural diversity, right, is a problem because there are already many cultures, is not the reason why you have cultural difference. Cultural difference is a particular constructed discourse at a time when something is being challenged about power or authority. Mm-hmm. At that point, a particular cultural trait or tradition, the smell of somebody's food, the color of their skin, the accent that they speak with, their particular history, be it Irish or Indian or Jewish, it's a much more problematic and sophisticated reproduction of a ritual, a habit, a trait, a characteristic. And that reproduction has to bear a whole set of significations, tensions, anxieties. And it becomes the sign of those tensions and anxieties. Cultural difference is not difficult, if you like, because there are many diverse cultures. It is because there is some particular issue about the redistribution of goods between cultures, or the funding of cultures, or the emergence of minorities or immigrants in a situation of resources, where resource allocation has to go on, or the construction of schools and the idea of whether the school should be bilingual or trilingual or whatever. It is at that point that the problem of cultural difference is produced. So it's really an argument against the naturalism of the notion of culture.
This is good, and this is actually going to be very useful to, especially since so many people are dealing with multiculturalism right now. Number eight, in your discussion of what the prefix post in postcolonial means, you write, postcoloniality is a salutary reminder of the persistent neocolonial relations within the new world order and the multinational division of labor. Beyond this, however, postcolonial critique bears witness to those countries and communities constituted otherwise than modernity. Such cultures of a postcolonial contra-modernity may be contingent to modernity, discontinuous or in contention with it, resistant to its oppressive assimilationist technologies. But they also deploy the cultural hybridity of their borderline conditions to translate and therefore reinscribe the social imaginary of modernity. Postcoloniality, in your view, is clearly neither another school of criticism nor a mere extension of postmodernism as the celebration of the fragmentation of the grand narratives of the post-Enlightenment rationalism, which you call a profoundly parochial enterprise. What's striking here, and what we would like you to explain further, is your view of postcolonialism as a spatial and temporal project that opens up an intervening space and revisionary time in modernity.
Thank you. Now, this is a very large question,
yes.
And in order to, and I have to restrict it somewhat in answering it. So,
well,
this is the tack I decided I would take. I want to follow very closely your suggestion to me that I should locate the notion of the postcolonial in and as a spatial and temporal project, and in addition to that, a revisionary temporal and spatial project. And let me say, therefore, that to put it very directly, I think it is the responsibility, theoretical, ethical, and aesthetic, political, of what we may call post-colonial discourse, which is a term which has its own problems. But I think its usefulness is, for me, is fundamentally to remind us that what was some people's modernity was somebody else's colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I would also suggest that, and say to those who suggest that the word post-colonial bucks the responsibility of a term like neo-colonial,
mm-hmm.
I would say, A, they are not exclusive, and they need not be, the one does not obliterate the other. But the usefulness of that ambiguous and ambivalent post before colonial is there to draw attention to this anteriority, this early emergence, where modernity is emerging in and through a very complex negotiation with its own colonial double life. That's the point. That at the point at which the notion of universality as an ethical and political value is emerging, at that very moment, a discourse in the name of universality, a discourse of discrimination, of marginalization, of the negation of autonomy, is being produced by those very cultures themselves in the colonial site. So I think the post-colonial does not only refer us to indigenous agencies in the colonial world, but also gives us a sense of how Western modernity has its own colonial anteriority and not the kind of claims to origin that it claims for itself. You know, very often modernity, in its desire for democracy or whatever, might make a claim to some Greek ideal. But I think they should also, at that point, make a claim to the colonial reality in relation to which it is elaborating its own modernity. Whether that modernity is the notion of nationhood or civility or civil society or civic society or civic virtue. So to me, the most important thing about the post-colonial project is to make one aware of the global and transnational history of those very early moments of modernity and the various obdurate and incommensurable and aporetic tensions that modernity has to become ethically and politically aware of, and post-modernity also has to become ethically and politically aware of in claiming some discursive or political or spatial authority for itself. So to me that's absolutely crucial. And that's why, you know, the idea that we, you know, people who talk about the post-colonial somehow neglect the very important neo-colonial social and political arrangements of the contemporary world, the international division of labor, the iniquities of the International Monetary Fund, etc., etc., I think are somewhat missing the point.
Yes.
Because first of all, they're not exclusive.
Yes.
And secondly, it would enhance such a reading of neocolonialism or neocoloniality if it were able to take the emergence of the history of modernity to that place that post-colonialism is trying to indicate. So I think that's really the key to that question.
Thank you. Hybridity is a central concept, of course, in your critical project. You write, hybridity is no jejune postmodern lark, nor is it simply my invention. It comes from James Baldwin's profound meditation on the unique power and pathos of the American color line. Hybridity is not about new alloys conceived in an amoral state of historical amnesia. It is not about cultural appropriation or assimilation subsumed in a celebration of citizenship. Hybridity, as Baldwin testifies, is a form of social and psychic recognition. It is an awareness of the graftings, transitions, and translations through which we define our present and articulate an ethics equal to the way we live now. Will you explain how hybridity as a form of social and psychic recognition is not assimilable to a liberal politics of recognition, but instead must disrupt it and its non-differential concept of cultural time?
Yes, thank you very much. Let me just take us back a little bit to a question you asked me earlier, which really prepares us for this particular problem. And that is I want to remind ourselves of what I said about writing and communication and discourse. And I think the important issue here is that the similarity here in this respect, that just as the notion of inscription does not allow there to be a pre-constituted subject. That doesn't mean that people are not there prior to the speech act. It just means that in and through the performance of the speech act, those positionalities have acquired different significances. In the same way, here, when we talk about hybridity, as opposed to the politics of recognition, we are making a similar distinction. The politics of recognition assumes that the parties to that recognition, whether it's in the Hegelian master-slave model, or any other model of a kind of mutual, culturally relativistic recognition, you know, in that sense, it assumes that there is this kind of in place, these subjects in and through whom the process of recognition happens. And I think the question of hybridization is precisely to draw attention to the way in which the process of negotiation is continually placing and replacing the members of that act of cultural or social or political interaction. So I think, first of all, the subject of hybridization is a different subject than the subject of the politics of recognition. The subject of hybridization is an enunciatory subject. In the enunciatory subject, which is a subject in performance and process, the notion of what is to be authorized, what is to be deauthorized, what is the difference which will be signified, what is the similarity or the similitude that will be articulated, these things are continually happening in the very process of discourse making or meaning making. They are not subjects which are already given to that process of enunciation. The important thing about the process of enunciation as a kind of borderline concept is that it is aware that it is through the process of enunciation that the borders between objects or subjects or practices are being constituted. And I think there is therefore it really does contest most of the theories of the liberal individualization, or most of the liberal theories of individualization as being the process of subject formation. So I think it attacks precisely the punctuality of the notion of a liberal individual subject. That means that there is no naivety in the construction of the liberal individual subject. You know, it's not as if it's some, as often it is represented as being as some kind of completely ahistorical, conceived in an ahistorical and universal way. It's not even that bugs me particularly, or that I find difficult. I think what I do find difficult is that it somehow, that subject is always on time. Its priority always depends upon it being absolutely timely, so timely in fact, that its universality is each time affirmed, its position prior to the process of enunciation is each time valorized. And it's that punctuality of the subject that I think the concept of enunciation, which is central to the process of hybridization, contests. And if you think about it, just for a moment, if you think about some influential images of the theoretical images of the subject, each of them contests punctuality. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you think about the Althusserian concept of interpolation as one very popular notion of the way of thinking about the subject in contemporary theory, cultural studies, certainly, although Al Jazeera is no longer invoked, you know, much of Jameson, much of Eagleton, much of a whole materialist Marxist cultural studies group still work around that subject willy-nilly.
Right.
Well, if you think about that, there you have in the structure of interpolation, an interpolated subject, you have the contest to what I've called individualist punctuality, by saying the subject is by its very nature overdetermined or displaced. You know. Althusser has to therefore make his move towards Lacan to construct that subject, Freud and Lacan. Now, of course, the limitation of that is dictated much more by his desire to enshrine a kind of structuralist Marxism where the subject can't also be terribly errant and in movement. The subject has to be fixed. So what he gives with one end, he takes away with the other. He gives this notion of overdetermination and displacement by his move towards Lacan, towards the unconscious. But then, of course, he pulls back at that point and says, however, as you know, the subject is not an individualist subject, it's a produced subject, it's a displaced and overdetermined subject, but it is the subject of the Lacanian imaginary. By taking that move, he takes the subject out of the flux and gives it a kind of punctuality, the imaginary relation being the most stable of all the relations of identification in Lacan. So what I'm saying is not that, you know, we've got to move from the one kind of subject to another kind of subject. We've got to move from timeliness to eternal belatedness. If we choose between those things, then there is no real choice. All we're doing is moving one counter instead of another. I think, therefore, what ambivalence is important, it's a theoretical idea, is that we've got to continually calculate the tensions between these positions. That's why I've always been opposed to this way of doing cultural theory or doing theory in general, which is always looking for more and more accurate notions of contradiction, subject, or whatever. You know, we don't want the Lacanian one, now we've got to do the Lacanian, Kantian version of it. If only we could get the subject right, if only we could get the object right, you know. And I've always been opposed to that. But it's this opening up the problem of the opening up the question of the subject by opening up the question of its non-punctual evocation. That's important. That's why I've been so insistent upon raising questions of disjunctive temporality at the point of enunciation. That is why, to me, the question of cultural difference is not the problem that of there being diverse cultures, and that diversity produces the difference. It is that each time one wants to judge a particular or make a judgment upon culture or on a certain element within a culture, in the context, as I said earlier, of some kind of social and political condition that puts pressure on that judgment, you are standing at that point in this disjunctive difference-making site. And you cannot avoid that is where, in that disjunctive and slippery and problematic terrain, is where your foot cannot fixedly grow.
That's wonderful.
Well, we may need to clean it up a little bit. Or something.
Do you want to invite your... You don't have to, you can come in and out without worrying about us. And I don't...
I've been sitting here wanting to test his education.
Okay, number 10. In the postcolonial and postmodern, you write, the postcolonial perspective forces...
I've lost my stop.
And I'll have this here too. The postcolonial perspective forces us to rethink the profound limitations of a consensual and collusive liberal sense of cultural community. It insists that culture and political identity are constructed through a process of alterity. Questions of race and cultural difference overlay issues of sexuality and gender and overdetermine the social alliances of class and democratic socialism. the time for assimilating minorities to holistic and organic notions of cultural value has dramatically passed. The very language of cultural community needs to be rethought from a post-colonial perspective. Is the liberal concept of community then inherently flawed? And if so, what do you think of the of critical projects such as Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe that propose a hegemonic strategy for the left that does not renounce liberal democratic ideology but attempts to deepen and expand it?
Thank you. I think the answer to that question must rest on what we understand by deepening and and expanding. I think that's the issue here. I mean, my sense is that I was with Chantal and Ernesto, who are, you know, in recently, and I think that much of what Chantal is developing as a kind of agonistic democracy is something for which I have a good deal of time. Mm-hmm. My sense, so in terms of that difference, I don't so much want to define it against what they're doing, because I think there are many things that we share, and a whole history of thinking that we share too. But I think that what I'm concerned about is the basis on which consent and consensuality as a guiding principle of liberal community puts into place a particular notion of what a subject is, which I think I would be, as I said earlier on, I won't repeat myself,
right,
would be different. B, what culture is as signification, which I've also talked about in terms of enunciation. It's very difficult to accommodate that notion of the disjunctive ground of the enunciative. Liberal communities can deal with contradiction. And indeed, need contradiction to test the metal of tolerance. That they absolutely need. But whereas, can they deal with the disjunctive, as I said, can they deal with the aporetic, and can they deal with ambivalence in the way in which I suggested it? Isn't there a tendency each time to deal with difference or tolerance by pre-constituting communities and giving each community its authenticity and integrity and saying what we're choosing is between, you know, the difference is actually integrally and expressively contained within each one. We're choosing between them, and between them we choose with various criteria. But my thinking of an enunciative community starts off very differently. The whole basis on which constitution takes place is different. So I think that that's another way in which the notion of the liberal community, in my view, would be different. And finally, I think that that really within liberal theories of community, and I realize that I'm biting off, you know, a large chunk and trying to be succinct about it, there isn't often an adequate attention to the fact that the group or the community as a meaning-producing entity, as a communicative entity, there isn't enough of an attention to the fact that the group as an agent cannot be conceived of as a group of individuals. Mm-hmm. That we need another way of thinking what it is that is a group interest or a group demand, which does not simply conceive of groupishness as a position negotiated amongst individuals. I have no idea. I have some idea that what I'm saying would need us to complicate the whole notion of group identification in and through a more psychoanalytic way of thinking. I have, at this point, very little. So theoretically, I can see what needs to be done. But I'm not, at this point, in a position to say that if we started thinking like that, how would it cash out in terms of very important policy-driven, practical, political considerations? Mm-hmm. It would be like saying, if you raise the question, Gerald, if you raise the question of the phantasmatic, or fantasy, social fantasy, in the construction of the Cheru, if you raise that question in the construction of a particular political position, you know, how or what would you, what kind of subject would, how would a court recognize that, or how would a policy institution recognize that? That's a question I'm not entirely clear on at the moment. But I think it's for those reasons that I would say that what I'm suggesting would require not so much a deepening of the liberal ideology as a necessary, and in the Derridean sense, an erasure of it. And by that I do mean, and I think you have highlighted to me something that I knew but had not seen demonstrated, that amongst the various theories and positions and forms of discourse that I have been in conversation with, right from the very beginning, I seem to have been more or less naively in conversation with the history of liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Something that you really have made me aware of. In studying your questions and in thinking of a response to them.
Well, certainly that position makes a lot of sense to me.
Okay.
May I
have
to continue?
No, I have nothing.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much for having me to say
that. Number 11. In The Commitment to Theory, you offer an important view of the concept of hegemony, saying that the work of hegemony hegemony is itself the process of iteration and differentiation. It depends on the production of alternative or antagonistic images that are always produced side by side and in competition with each other. It is this side by side nature, this partial presence or metonymy of antagonism and its effective significations that give meaning, quite literally, to a politics of struggle as the struggle of identification and the war of positions. It is therefore problematic to think of it as sublated into an image of the collective will. Now, doesn't the work of hegemony and political struggle also involve an attempt to fix and prefix images, meanings, and values, and thereby subsume and sublate social antagonism?
Yes, it does, but within a general landscape of the iterative. Within a general landscape of the contingent. Oh. It's a different thing to think about fixation within an economy of iteration and contingency than to think of fixation within a more, I don't know, universalistic or a more communicational or expressive model of the subject or a meaning. It's the question of hegemonic fixation, as I'm suggesting it, depends upon the profound liminality and instability of the question of representation.
Mm.
That's what we've been talking about in trying to move away from the notion of the subject of recognition to the subject of enunciation. That, you know, that's where we've been moving, I think, rather neatly here. And therefore, I feel that fixation has a very different value when you see it in the trammels of representation, rather than if you see it, you know, as the destiny and the teleology of representation.
Thank you. Much of your work insists on the importance.
So let me just. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Other thing. No, yes. It's not you. It's just that I should have said this earlier. When you, but your very interesting question also made me think of something else. There is a kind of narrative or image of power, which has also been one of the specters that we've been, ghosts we've been dealing with in our discussion, that somehow assumes that power works because somewhere prior to a particular exercise of authority, it has been fixed. Mm-hmm. It has a fix. It works because it has already been institutionalized, or, you know, it's been prefixed in a way, just to put a bum on the road. And I think, to some extent, of course, that is true. You enter into a negotiation only because there is a disequilibrium or an inequality. But I think how you negotiate depends very much on how you read the weightage and sedimentation of that prior fixing or prefixing of power or authority or domination. It's to try and rethink the context of that prefixing, to suggest that that prefixing may also be disarticulated or unfixed, that I've always suggested that let us think about the moment of prefixing as a kind of anteriority that does itself in the present, in the moment where you're negotiating, produce its kind of alterity. That's how I want to also try and rethink the pre. Mm-hmm. The pre is not a givenness, but an anteriority.
Actually, I'm glad that you added that. Thank you. Much of your work insists, I'm going to ask this actually as to, there's a follow-up, you see, underneath it. Much of your work insists on the importance of interrogating the mode of representation of otherness. And the other question, for example, you write, an important feature of colonial discourse is its dependence on the concept of fixity. Right there with fixity. In the ideological construction of otherness. But fixity, as you remind us, is a paradoxical state of representation. It connotes rigidity and an unchanging order, as well as disorder, degeneracy, and demonic repetition. As you point out, one of the principal strategies of fixity is the stereotype, which is not a simplification because it is a false representation of a given reality. It is a simplification because it is an arrested, fixated form of representation that denies the play of difference. The consequence is that the stereotype impedes the circulation and articulation of, for example, the signifier race as anything other than its fixity as racism. What strategies might we take to rethink race beyond the limitations of fixity?
Do you want to ask the other question?
Would you prefer to do them together?
Let's try that.
Okay. And also, in the national discourse on race here in the U.S., the media now regularly calls on people of color to represent divergent political positions on various issues. Does this development suggest that fixed notions of race may be loosening up somewhat?
Right. Let me say that one of the ways in which we can, and which history, if you like, or historical situations have made us, and political struggles have made us rethink race beyond the limitations of its fixity, has been the way in which race theory, you know, so popular in the 19th century, the race theory, the integrity of race theory as a discourse has itself been generally questioned. You know, its object is no longer unitary or fixed. But I think also the history of political movements has showed us that what we think of as the politics of difference, what we think of as the politics of multiculturalism, popularly put, what we think of as the politics of new social movements, do not allow you to think the subject of any one of those markings, race, gender, class, culture, geopolitical location, or generation. We cannot think those things exclusively in themselves. Because, I believe, of the concept of difference that I've been trying to explore that underlies them. We're always, funnily, as I say in that piece on minority maneuvers, we're always in the middle of difference. Mm-hmm. If there is anything about the theoretical work that I've been doing, it has been to shift, whether it's at the level of enunciation, whether it's at the level of subject formation, to shift away from this idea that there is, that the politics of difference consists in the putting together of one originary marking with another originary marking and a third one, one being race, one being sex. Mm-hmm. One. These are always, in a way, being constituted and negotiated in a cross-boundary process. That does not mean that at any particular time you may want to emphasize one particular strategy of difference or one particular form of identification rather than another. That is perfectly possible. But as we know it, what is impossible is to, in a sense, take the textuality of difference and separate its threads. Because somehow the effectivity of thinking through difference is to keep thinking through these nodal textiles and not to give any one of them temporarily a prior or an a priori authority. So I think that's very important to understand within the general conspects of a theory of difference. Now, let me also say something else, that it's very important to understand what the theory of identification allows us to understand. Identification as a process of the iterative, as an enunciatory process. What it allows us to understand is not just that we identify one on one, or one on the other, if I might play with something. It's not just who you identify with, mm-hmm. but what you identify with in that mm-hmm. object. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a way of thinking the politics of difference. So that the articulation between, say, for instance, a certain feminist position and a certain position on race, both those positions will be substantially transformed because of the object around which they decide to negotiate an articulation between themselves. It could be if it's housing or education, if it's education in an African American US community, then the coming together of feminism and the question of race will not be defined by the prior given concepts, race or signs, race, gender. They will be reconstituted in and through a negotiation with this third space or this third thing, which in a way disjuncts any sense of the two of them, you know, doing just some kind of simple dealing with each other. It's negotiation is always a double dealing, you know, a doubling dealing, not only a double dealing, a doubling dealing. So it seems to me, of course, context is very important. If you're thinking then about class issues and education issues and race issues in Muslim minorities in Paris, there's a very different sign of what is class, or indeed because that sign of class will be classed through a certain kind of post-colonial migration and resettlement. So my sense is that we think beyond the limitations of fixed city, because the form of difference and enunciation that I've been suggesting pushes us never to be contained by any sign for longer than its rearticulation or translation demands. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Is that very much.
All right. Let us go just here to the U.S. case that you... and I think that's a very interesting issue to bring up in this context, because it calls on people of color to represent divergent political positions on various issues, so long as their diversity is contained by a kind of ideological and political matrix which always makes them into little nations. They have to be sub-nations, you know? They have to see their context in a as a sub-national context. This is, you know, one of the most influential works recently in this area is Will Kimlicker's Multicultural Citizenship. Okay. I mean, you cannot read anything without references to Kimlicker's work. Now, he's very clear. He says, you know, the only way in which minorities in the long run will be able to conceive of themselves as being participants in wider cultures is to accept the national or subnational form. Okay. I want to, in the final, just look that up and make sure that I'm quoting him absolutely correctly. But I think, you know, that's the issue. Represent yourself as a little national minority, and of course we will support you. But seep in, disseminate in, and change and translate what are seen to be the dominant lines of the transmission of cultural tradition, of national ritual, then we're not so sure. You know, become a virus, and we don't want you. Remain virtuous in the national mode, and you know, you can come and join the mixed salad or the melting pot or, you know, the cassoulet or the casserole or whatever else you like, you know, sit at our table.
That's very good. By the way, we're about 2/3 of the way through, and if you need at all for any reason to take a break, you'll...
No, I'm fine.
Okay. In several of your works, you theorize a cultural construction of nations.
Are you all right? You're not cold?
I'm fine.
You too?
Yeah, fine.
Can I get you anything to drink? Or?
You theorize a cultural construction of nationness as a form of social and textual affiliation. For example, you say that the project of nation and narration is to explore the genus-faced ambivalence of language itself in the construction of the genus-faced discourse of the nation. You write, to study the nation through its narrative address does not merely draw attention to its language and rhetoric. It also attempts to alter the conceptual object itself, something you were referring to before. If the problematic closure of textuality questions the totalization of national culture, then its positive value lies in displaying the wide dissemination through which we construct the field of meanings and symbols associated with national life. Now you seem to believe then that critical theory has the potential to help rewrite the nation, to alter the material realities as well as the symbolic content of nationness. What specific strategies do you see critical theory developing to effect such changes?
Thank you. Let me just say three things. One, I think the critical theory, in its obstruction to the process of totalization, allows us to reconceive of a very potent myth in the construction of homogeneous societies. That is the myth of the national past.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's obvious from what I've been saying about the iterative temporality of national cultural enunciation, why that would unsettle the notion of a continuous past. But it also allows us, for reasons that take us right back to your almost your first or second question, the question of sententiousness. We do not, if a critical theory in allowing us to break down or break through or write across or run across sententiousness of national, of the discourses of national life, allows us to see the residual and emergent forces often linked with communities of interest, with the way in which, say, national self-belonging can, for AIDS and gay communities, be mediated through the notion of mourning, melancholia, illness, and citizenship, and effective citizenship. You know, just to give you one example of what I think the sententiousness of citizenship, one broken down, can open out into. We could think about similar ways in which, you know, women's movement can also emerge out of this, you know, trumping or negotiating or displacing the sententious. So I think not by rethinking what authority and tradition is, by, as I said, through the treachery of trumping the sententious, not only allows for sites of emergence, that emergence, and I've talked about, you know, the emergence of, say, gay community, allows you to rethink the notion of the people. What is the people? What is the national people? That great, if the past is the myth of the nation, you know, in a displaced time, the past, the people is the recurrent myth of every national discourse about its presentness. The presentness of the nation that we propose is often symbolized in a notion of a people. Its contemporaneity is always the people. And I think that to study it through its narrative, to study nationhood through its narrative address, must make you question what it means to construct a people, or how a people is inscribed, or what is, or how a discourse creates its own authority by referencing a people. It makes you rethink that. And in fact, in Nation and Narration, where I deal with the concept of the pedagogical and the performative as a kind of agonistic and ambivalent construction of the nation, the fulcrum of that argument is how we may rethink the notion of the people. So the past, I think, can be rethought. I think the present, i.e. the notion of the people, can be rethought. And I think there is another way in which critical theory, which is very interested, I think, productively, in seeing boundaries not as simply the space between one nation, another, oneself and another, but seeing the boundary as always also facing inward, as some kind of internal liminal space, allows us to think more generally of a way of connecting nations or countries, not by using the national form as a currency of exchange, but by using those kinds of minorities within nations who are always seen as both partly belonging to and not belonging enough. You know, that partial condition becomes a way of making a transnational articulation. For instance, ecological movements very often. That seem, that are, and a number of minority groups that are seen to be, by nature of the demand they make, or by who they are, or the voice they articulate, are seen to be neither inside nor outside, often find their theater of action by moving across boundaries to those other groups who occupy similar ambivalent and liminal positions outside. So I think there is a way of moving, a different way of elaborating the transnational, rather than using the nation as the counter of exchange. Mm-hmm.
Three related questions then to this about nation. In dissemination, you make what is for us a provocative but underdeveloped statement that identifies literacy as one of the instruments for narrating the nation. In this context, you say that historians and political theorists, and we might add compositionists, ignore literacy in an effort to evade the essential question of the representation of the nation as a temporal process. Would you elaborate on what you see as the role that literacy and perhaps literacy instruction play in the constitution and interrogation of the nation?
Thank you. I think this is a very important question, and coming as I do from India, it has a very specific significance for me. I feel that literacy is connected intimately and institutionally with the question of democratic representation. It's more complex than saying you can't really have a one-man or one-person, one-vote system unless you have literacy, because people are open then to all kinds of pressures, particularly in poorer countries where, you know, votes can be bought and sold, but of course votes can be bought and sold in Chicago or in, you know, in many other places too. It's not limited to the South. But I do think that literacy is absolutely crucial for a kind of ability to be responsible to yourself, to make your own reading within a situation of political and cultural choice. But I think, And in the Indian context, fascinatingly, you know, the state of Kerala in the South has the highest, has had effectively the highest literacy. That literacy, fostered very much by Jesuit and Catholic missionaries. And of course, Kerala has been, or was till, I think recently, I'm not sure of the situation at the moment, the state which had communist rule in an unbroken period of, I don't know, 15 or 20 years. So there was this particular collaboration between Catholicism, communism, literacy, and democratic development. I mean, you know. So I think literacy is very important for the representation of selfhood, by which I'm not talking about individuals, I'm just for the representation of self-representation within a democratic foundation. But I think that there's no doubt that literacy is also in some ways an equalizing force. There is a danger, of course, in fetishizing literacy. A kind of fetishism that is obvious when you say, when people say, oh, you know, and I'm talking about literacy in a more general sense. Oh, you know, we have this terrible racism. It's because, you know, people don't know enough about another culture. They don't know how to appreciate another's language or another's cuisine. You know, that's a load of crap. I mean, you know, racism is often the leading ideology of the most educated and literate people. So I think, you know, it's not that's not important. But I think the kind of composition, the kind of writing, the kind of literacy that we have been talking about, which is not merely about competence, mm-hmm. but it is about intervention, the possibility of interpretation as intervention, as interrogation, as relocation, as revision. I think it's that kind of literacy that is often not taught even at the best institutions and should be taught about and taught much more.
We were hoping you would say something along those lines.
Have I done the right thing?
You did wonderful.
Have the answers been uniformly satisfactory?
Uniformly
I mean, you were
extraordinary.
All right, you heard many, many people, so you are the better judge than I am.
Two more about that connect up with Nietzsche. Sure. But by the way, just not for the tape, but just very quickly out of curiosity, are you familiar with Paulo Freire's work?
Some.
You know, because it says some very similar kind of thing.
You know, just last weekend there was this conference I was at on my own work, and then I came back from that and I was at the Divinity School here, which is a remarkable institution. I don't know if you know what the University of Chicago Divinity School is, but I mean, if you want to go do a workshop on Lacan, you go to the Divinity School. If you want to know more about Foucault, you go to the Divinity School. If you want to find students who are working on the sort of religious symbolism in Persian rugs, you go to the Divinity School. I mean, it's an unbelievable institution. Queer theorists, you go to the Divinity School.
Amazing.
It really is. I mean, you know, in all the things, it's always the leading Divinity School, but it's just an amazing intellectual place. As many institutions here are, there's a real ferment of ideas here. But and I did a panel there. I mean, I did a keynote there at a conference. I came from this other one, and my discussants were Wendy Doniger. Do you know Wendy Doniger?
I heard that.
She works a lot on Indian mythology. So there was Wendy Doniger, and then there were two other people, one from the Princeton Theological Seminary, and another guy from, Michigan or NYU or something. But both of them were doing a take on my work from certain perspectives of liberation theology.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, making some very interesting connections. And I know that Freire is different, but...
Well, that's right. But
he has some,
and there's also a connection through Ivan Ilyich.
That's right. So I just wanted to say that, yes, they pointed that out too. Right, your other question.
How do we counter the growing popularity of the claim that the unity of the nation as a symbolic force has been superseded by those new realities of internationalism, multinationalism, or even late capitalism? In other words, how do we demonstrate that there is little that is new in the rhetoric of these global terms, for they are most often underwritten, as you say, in that grim prose of power that each nation can wield within its own sphere.
Yes, thank you. Let me take that question in two parts. First of all, let me take up Barbara, where I said there's not little that is new in the rhetoric of these global terms. Here, now, of course, there are many new things. I think digital technology has speeded up, this transnational process. But, and I accept that that speeding up is not just a quantitative issue, it's a qualitative issue. It can be fetishized as a kind of technophilia around which things that, because you can, and I'll come to that in a minute, but I think that's a very important issue here, that feels that, because you can conjure up anybody who you want at more or less any time through email, we have now transcended time and space and geographies and, inequalities and disjunctions. Only so long as both of you can have connectivity, that you have a computer, that you are, you know that, it's too familiar, I won't rehearse that. But I do want to say that I just want to remind myself that really the first globalization was mercantilism and colonialism. Now, of course, the difference there was that I once calculated that it took something, and it's not an accurate calculation, it took something like five or six months in that era the early 19th, mid-19th century, early 19th century, to make the kind of colonial, to make colonial connectivity, you know. In London, they produced an edict which was to be enacted in India, then they sent it by ship, then they distributed it through India, and then the viceroy wrote a report as to whether it worked or not, sent it back. So before they could actually reconsider what they'd done, it took about 5 or 6 months. Now, of course, it takes, you know, 2 minutes for some global organization to effect a change in policy. But I think what I was getting at there was that there is an obduracy of certain power blocks and power forces that can translate the, particularly at the economic level, that can translate the power of the transnational for very parochial, even nationalist concerns. At the level of institutions, at the level of ideologies, at the level of economies. So that there is no guarantee that translationality and transnationality, which I see as being linked, will not be used for the most nationalistic ends. For instance, if you speak now to these Hindu nationalists in India, you know, who are really now very seriously contesting the cosmopolitanism of the Indian subcontinent, which was remarkable, you know, with their anti-Muslim acts, political acts, not just propaganda. If you ask them, they would say, our notion of nationalism, you know, our notion of Hinduism is very, very much a Western concept of the nation. Hinduism is a very tolerant religion. We believe in peace. All we are saying is that we want to have that kind of hegemonic function that, for instance, Protestantism as a state religion has in Britain. And then we will happily tolerate Muslims or anyone else, Parsis or Christians. So we are not, they will say, we are not archaic. We are absolutely out there in the transnational discourse. We see our desire for what they call Hindutva, or the Hindu state, as being absolutely in a translational relationship with Western nation forms. We're in fact modernists in a Western sense, and we're demanding this because we have a modern faith in Hinduism, which will be this umbrella. It'll be the normative form, but it'll be an umbrella very tolerant to all kinds of religions. So I do feel that, you know, there's a grim prose of nationalist and national authority. So my sense is, of course, not to say that in many ways this blurring of the boundary of nation has not taken place. It has. And it's often taken place through the question, through refugees, the 18 million displaced people for one reason or another, that you have 18 to 20 million, according to some United Nations figures. And I think they are producing what must be recognized as a kind of vernacular, or vernacularizing, or vernacular cosmopolitanism, internationally. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize, at the same time as we recognize the liminal form of nation, of the nation form, we have to recognize possibilities of actually using the transnational in a very national sense. I mean, you can sign whatever transnational agreement you want. You know, but very often what you find is that the ruling national elite channels and filters its benefits in its own direction. So I think that we should be more cautious in celebrating the transnational. And we should be aware that we are, certainly historically at the moment, at a level of, or in a place of, liminal nationality or nationhood.
A moment ago you spoke of the concept of the people, and I won't read this entire quote, but this is where you talk about the people as a doubling in double time. And we just wonder, what are the implications of thinking the people in this double time? Does such a conceptualization have the potential for generating social agency? You want me to read that? That's the In Your Discussions of Nationness you write.
Right. I think that's a very thoughtful question. Let me give you a brief answer. I think that there are two immediate effects implied by thinking of the people in a double time. One I've already referred to. That is, to see the nation as a internally liminal and bordered formation. And the second follows from that. That is, to see the way in which minorities or minoritization are very much part or the other side of the national people. That the problem of minoritization should be seen as a problem of nation construction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's usually seen as the abnorm, the thing that didn't work, or the adjacent thing, or the accidental. I'm saying that the construction of minorities is as much a process of nation formation as the construction of a national people. And in fact, the two may be as closely linked as I believe the emergence of the modern, of modernity, is to the emergence of coloniality.
Mm-hmm.
I think the effects of this would be to change the way in which we think of the citizenship of communities of interest, of minorities, migrants, refugees. I think we would have to rethink that those questions of citizenship if we did think in terms of what I've called the double time. So it's really a question, it's really to try and make us reconsider the question of cultural membership and national membership. I should have sent you this piece that I've just written on Freud on jokes, as a way of thinking about self, what I call self-critical communities. So now I'll send it to you maybe sometime. Can I just go to the loo for a second? Does anybody want to
have the tour? Actually, I wouldn't mind at all.
Okay.
You have said that your concern is with other articulations of human togetherness as they are related to cultural difference and discrimination, other than the liberal vision of togetherness. For instance, human togetherness may come to represent the forces of hegemonic authority, or a solidarity founded in victimization and suffering may implacably, sometimes violently, become bound against oppression, or a subaltern or minority agency may attempt to interrogate and rearticulate the inter-est of society that marginalizes its interests. Do you envision temporary strategic alliances as a way to bind individuals in social agency, as a way to rearticulate human togetherness?
Yes, I made that statement because somehow I made that statement because there was a sense that human togetherness had a kind of inherent value. Solidarity was what happened to the left, and sort of rather evil hegemony was what happened on the right. You know, they formed power blocks, we formed solidarities. And there's some truth in that, but I wanted to, I've always wanted to suggest that the real power of the political is the power of understanding how the political object, aim, constituency was actually a result of the ethical and practical labor of construction and negotiation. I always, so that I made that statement to get away from this sort of idea that, you know, and also this idea of, you know, the power block versus solidarity, but also to get away from the idea that if you had a kind of more social constructionist way of thinking, you would automatically come out on the right side, you know, and I just didn't think that I've always wanted to suggest you could come out completely on the wrong side. I mean, that's what politics is about, to be vigilant about that very moment in which, you know, groups are being constituted or idealized or objects are being created or whatever. But yes, I think that much of my work, I think of the piece on the Indian Mutiny in Location of Culture, has been an attempt to see social agency where it has mostly been denied, or because it hasn't ended up in great acts of revolutionary transformation. But then it has also been my purpose to say that, you know, that revolution is not something, or radical social transformation, you know, cannot be seen all together at the same time from one place. You've got to look at it in different moments and times, and things add to rather than necessarily add up. But I've always been interested, therefore, to stress that, in a way, this togetherness is also, if I may produce a rather bad sort of pun-like thing, it's also to be aware of the togetheringness. The gathering is as important as some assumption of a togetherness. It's been my desire to suggest that this expressive togetherness that that we assume that there are people, you know, the category of woman, the category of class, already is an expressive subject, is problematic, and I've tried to problematize that. And then I have also, in my work around enunciation and psychoanalytic identification, has also led me to want to understand not only, as I said a moment ago, agency in times and places where it is least acknowledged, but also to try and understand forms of agency that do not emanate from individual intention. I wanted to see the way in which in the construction of the collectivity, something else, some other body gets constituted as the site of a community or a togetherness. And I only use that awkward phrase, to gather, you know, because it actually stresses the important disseminatory potential that there must be in order to be able to think about a collectivity or a community.
Okay, good. 18. In the post-colonial and the postmodern, you write that a range of contemporary critical theories suggests that it is from those who have suffered the sentence of history, subjugation, domination, diaspora, displacement, that we learn our most enduring lessons for living and thinking. There's even a growing conviction that the affective experience of social marginalization, or marginality, as it emerges in non-canonical cultural forms, transforms our critical strategies. It forces us to confront the concept of culture outside objet théâtre, or beyond the canonization of the idea of aesthetics, to engage with culture as an uneven, incomplete production of meaning and value, often composed of incommensurable demands and practices produced in the art of the act of social survival. In the idea that the affective experience of social marginality has the potential to transform living and thinking, there is suggested the important role of political emotions. Those emotions, you know, for example, anger and outrage, that are produced in the act of survival. Do you think that political emotions provide an occasion for social solidarity, if not community? That is, are the affective experiences of social marginality incommensurable, just as our cultural meanings and values?
Yes, I think the answer to both those questions is yes. Yes, I do think that the structures of feeling, the structures of affect, are radically devalued in the language of political effectivity, cultural identity, and so on. I think, I'm going to elaborate on that, but I also think that the possibility that affect is both effective and incommensurable in a social and cultural sense must be entertained fully, and we must we must learn to work with that and to understand it. Now, I think my longer response to this is that the discourse of political action and political choice has concentrated too much on questions of interest and too little on questions of political passion. Of course, this was not always the case. In fact, that great book, The Passions and the Interests, by Hirschman, I think it was written in a way to track the history of the shift. But I do think that we are entering, that in our contemporary moment, the politics of difference, the politics of community, the politics of communities of interest has such a deep and strong affective charge to it that we have to now start beginning to understand the part that emotions, affects play in the construction of community politics. For instance, almost all the journalism, and the very effective journalism on Bosnia, has never failed to describe the almost perverse and pathological passion involved in the most horrific acts. I mean, if we see that, then we're saying something that is motivating that construction of the group, or that construction of the group in action, that construction of a performative subject, something that is constructing that is not just ethnic hatred or racial hatred. There is another charge that is working there, which is actually creating solidarity, creating a camp. And I think it is our responsibility to begin to understand it. Anger, violence, hatred, these are seemingly just adjectives always attached to what is seen as something more substantial. But I don't think that that is the right way round it. So I think a history of affect, as well as an affective history, are very important tasks, certainly for me, for the future. And having worked on the question of ambivalence quite in a sustained way, some of my new work is focusing around anxiety, you know, as an affect of social transition and translation. Let me also say that I believe that one of the great contributions of Frantz Fanon was to raise this question of the psychoaffective, the psychoaffective moment in the wider moment of political autonomy. His theory of violence, I believe, is not, as it is often read, as some kind of Sorelian excess or whatever, but I think it is part of this process of taking seriously the question of the body, the question of the emotions, the question of affect at the level of political identification.
In Black and White, read all over, you write, when a figure arises from behind the bleak mask to address a range of politics, rather publics, Black, White, academic, mm-hmm. and so on, there's a palpable anxiety, there we are, about his or her representative status. It is commonly held, after all, that the authenticity of the intellectual, whether conservative or radical, is founded on the possibility of free and unfettered choice among competing ideas and interests. By this logic, minority intellectuals lack the ethical autonomy to be properly representative because they lack the conditions of freedom. They are, so to speak,
Yeah.
The position you appear to be taking here seems to support the work of various feminist standpoint theorists, such as Donna Haraway, Sandra Harding, and Nancy Hartsock, who argue that positionality is actually a strength in the production of knowledge rather than a liability. Do you see any theoretical affinities between your work and feminist standpoint theory?
Yes, to the extent to which I think what we are both talking about is the importance of recognizing what the conditions of one's situatedness are. Number one, you know, where, what is one's situation? I think my notion of enunciation is one that contests or that affirms the need to each time understand what is happening at the place of utterance, what each iteration and reiteration of a particular sign, how it produces its own strategy, its own authority. And I think this is an emphasis on situatedness, which I think the standpoint theorists or feminist theorists also have. I think the other, as I understand it, the other shared idea would be an attempt to think about political action not merely as liberation, but also as an active an active process of survival. Survival is a very positive thing, not just as a, as what you do when you're not running around, you know, winning arguments and battles. You know, so, I think those are would be the two shared ideas, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. This is somewhat related to that. Mm. In Are You a Man or a Mouse, you suggest that in the study of masculinity, the aim should not be to deny or disavow masculinity, but to disturb its manifest destiny, to draw attention to it as an enunciative site and a prosthetic reality, a prefixing of the rules of gender and sexuality, and a kind of blocked reflexivity that is masked by an appeal to universalism and rationality. Do you see the new men's studies movements, particularly those inspired by and responsive to feminism and gay studies, bringing greater self-reflexivity to the history of the construction of masculinities? And maybe to polemicize the point slightly, are there significant limits to the self-reflexivity that a white straight man can bring to the study of white straight
You know, I need some help on that one, because I've really not followed this, the men's studies movement that far. So if you could just pose the question to me, or if you could pose the question to me in a way that would not require, I mean, give me the point. I don't know the movement so well.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of facets to the men's studies movement. It can be include the mythopoetic men's movement, Iron John, Robert Bly.
No, I know the names, but I know read the stuff.
But then there are a lot of cultural studies theorists who are also sort of moving in this direction. Paul Smith is one, his book, Discerning the Subject, years ago, sort of brought him to our attention. And so the men's studies that this question is particularly trying to probe you on is a response to feminism and to gay studies, and it's in a sense recognizing that men masculinities need to be studied in the same ways that feminists have studied the construction of femininity, etc.
And they're sympathetic to feminism.
To some extent they're sympathetic. To some extent they see feminism as being too exclusively about women, and which is actually my issue with men's studies, because I don't think feminism has been exclusively studying women. I mean, it's studied a lot of things, capitalism, patriarchy, etc., and men. I think, in a sense, maybe the question behind the question is, my concern about men's studies is that it's going to, in its investigation of difference, masculinities as difference, becomes a kind of cultural diversity, another sort of site for cultural diversity to sort of hijack notions of cultural difference, if you will. It's another franchise, in a sense. Men's studies is another franchise in the.
I know what you say. I don't know what to say to that, but I know exactly what you mean, because my instincts are very much with yours. Like, why should we, so women are exploited. Well, maybe men are exploited too. Maybe we should set up a little group and look at how we're being exploited,
exactly.
And that, dogs are exploited. Well, let's get our dogs together and whip them into some sense of their experience. I know exactly what you're saying. I don't know what to say to that, actually.
Okay.
I just don't know what to say to that. I mean, I may have a thought afterwards. I need to think about it.
That's
because
good.
What I do need to think about is, but on the one hand, if it is in response to certain feminist or queer interrogations, then one would say, it's not a bad thing. But on the other hand, there must be a way in which that kind of thing, even in the process of interrogation, makes you fetishize something about your own. I suppose what I would say there is, I'm interested in responding to the interrogations of feminism or queer theory and queer nation or whatever, or gay activism. I'm interested in what a white, straight white male group would want to identify itself as, and what would be its conditions of solidarity under those specific signifiers. Why would it want to foreground those signifiers to identify themselves? I mean, women, the most progressive parts of the women's movement don't just come together only because they happen to, be women. They come together because women as signs signify certain things about inequality, whatever. Queer movement, gay movement comes together because of, race movement comes together because, again, those signs signify certain terrains of political action. Now, I'm just interested in do you, in a white, straight, masculine, do you come in there as women come in saying, we're women and we're exploited? Do you come in there and say, you know, we're straight white men and we're exploiters? Or what do you do? You know, do you see what I'm saying? You know, how do you enter that discourse? They say, you know, now we want to understand the conditions under which we are exploiters.
Well, that may actually be part of of some of those interrogations.
Yeah, it may be, you know, I don't know. I want to know what case they would be making, not only against themselves but for themselves.
Well, that's, I think, a lot of the issue, to make a case for themselves.
Yeah, you know, what is easy, right? But I mean, I would be as untrusting of a group that sat around saying, you know, we're guilty, as I would be of a group that sat around and saying, you know, everybody's trying to make us feel guilty, we don't feel. I mean, I would want to know on both sides, you know, what claims are being made for themselves and what the themselves is in that. If you could edit that and make some...
I actually can.
I think that would be fine. I'll go with as much as I know now to say.
Two more.
Good.
In the location of culture, translation becomes almost the paradigmatic instance of the performative nature of cultural communication. It is language in actu, enunciation, positionality, rather than language in situ. And the sign of translation continually tells or tolls the different times and spaces between cultural authority and its performative practices. The time of translation consists in that movement of meaning, the principle and practice of a communication that, in the words of Paul de Man, puts the original in motion to decanonize it, giving it the movement of fragmentation, a wandering of errands, a kind of permanent exile. Your self-conscious use of the word tolls is provocative. Would you more fully explain your view of the task and responsibility of translation?
Well, you know, let me respond to the use of the word tolls straight away. I put that there to emphasize that in the very telling, i.e. in the discursive act of the translational process, there has to be a sense that every translation is at once the death of something and its revival. That there's a sort of a spectral logic, as Derrida would say, in the construction of translation. In fact, somewhere, I think, when talking of translation, Derrida has said, you know, translation in stimulated by Benjamin, he says, you know, translation is about survival, survivre, living on a borderline, as well as living on, just the act of living on. And in a way, I think I use the word tolls there to indicate that complex sense of both the death of meaning and its relocation in the act of translation, or in the act of cultural translation. That's why I used that particular word. I think the task and responsibility of translation, which is, after all, the task and responsibility of not only of transferring or relocating meaning, but it is the responsibility of setting up a site of revisionary meaning, which means that which you receive is also being revised. That produces an enormous responsibility to the present, to the future, and to what has gone before, if you put it in temporal terms. And it produces this responsibility because through this whole process of the rearticulation of these temporalities, you also are addressing oneself, one is addressing oneself to a act of judgment about where you stand in the process of transition, you know, where you will go to through translation. But I think, as I have said before, that translation as a form of enunciation is an ethical act, because one is from a position of midstness, of being in the middle of difference, if you like, as I've called it elsewhere. One is taking the responsibility to deauthorize something that has put itself about as being the pace of the powerful or the original, and one is revaluing a genealogy in order to revise, to empower, to resituate a set of concerns or a set of identifications. And that act of both the acts of empowering and deauthorizing must be undertaken with the greatest reflection, circumspection, and modesty.
Final question. In your writings, you have taken numerous controversial, and some say radical, positions. And given the complexity of the ideas you're struggling with, it would not be unusual that some readers might misconstrue some of your positions. Are there any misunderstandings or critiques of your work that you care to address at this time?
Well, this has been such, for me, such a rich self-exploration, or a rich exploration of what I've done, that large, entirely due to your skill, I feel myself completely understood in a moment of luminous clarity, which I'm sure is completely wrong. It's entirely to do with you and not to do with me, or what I've written. But I think, you know, there are some, so I don't know what to say. I mean, yes, people, you know, point to a whole range of things, often in a complimentary way, sometimes in a critical way. But there are some things that are misunderstood. And I just list them. I don't want to necessarily go through them, but that's for other people too. But let me just tell you, I think very often what I've talked about as ambivalence is misunderstood as ambiguity. And they're radically different things. Ambivalence is is a struggle for identification. You know, ambiguity is a much more hermeneutic process. There may be some ambiguity and ambivalence, but they're not the same thing. I think where I have tried to, in a way, contest certain traditions of intentionality in order to be able to open up the question of agency and to see agency in acts that are often not seen as agential, people have misunderstood that, I think rather ludicrously, as a complete loss of any agency. Where I have tried in the same vein and in pursuit of the same kind of value, I have tried to address myself quite often to archival moments, literally moments in the historical or discursive or theoretical archive, which have been overlooked. People have sometimes, not often, I have to say, but I did see recently one case where these moments where I actually go into the archive to reconstruct the missionary discourse, as in Science Fiction for Wonders or the Indian Mutiny, people have seen these moments as purely anecdotal. Mm-hmm. And they pose the question, you know, where is the history there? The fact that I talk about these moments, I talk about the printing industry, I talk about the practice, both the ideological and the discursive practice of missionaries, the fact that I locate this within the kind of if you like, quasi-state governance of the East India Company. Somehow that's not history enough for some people. They want a different kind of narrative history, because I will not give them an easily continuous, conjoined history larded with large generalizations about state formation or quote-unquote exploitation or quote-unquote resistance or whatever. They feel that this is not a history, but that's not my problem in a way. It's I want to do a different kind of work. I want to I feel that the task is demanding of historicity, which I think I to some extent satisfy, but I think there is a demand by critics for a kind of historicism, a particular kind of narrative history, which I don't. I mean, it's not that I never produce it, but I don't. It's not my dominant mode. Yes, and finally, I think there is a misunderstanding at times of my notion of hybridization. For me, hybridization is really about how you negotiate between cultures or between power, how you negotiate between texts or cultures or practices in a situation of power imbalances, in order to be able to see the way in which strategies of appropriation, revision, and iteration can produce possibilities for those who are less advantaged to be able to actually grasp in a moment of emergency, in the very process of the exchange or the negotiation, to grasp the advantage. And this is somehow, and it's much more a social and cultural and enunciated process in my work, hybridization. It's not about people who, you know, eat Chinese, wear Italian clothes, and somehow it's been
diversity.
It's been sort of at sometimes in a very complimentary way to me personally. It's been taken to mean some kind of diversity or multiple identities or whatever. And I think for me, hybridization is a discursive, enunciatory, cultural, subjective process to do with the struggle around authority, authorization, deauthorization, the revision of authority, empowerment. These are the things it's to do with. It's a process, a social process. It's not about persons of diverse cultural tastes and fashions.
It's good that you point those out.
Yeah, those are the.
I want to thank you very, very
much. Well, it's been a